From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dick Wolf, the creator and executive producer of Law & Order and its two spin-offs, Special Victims Unit and Criminal Intent. With over 300 episodes over 13 years, Law & Order is the longest-running drama on television. There's a new book that collects photographs from its crime scenes and new DVD collections of the first season of each of the Law & Order shows. Also, we talk with Robert Downey Jr. about acting and his life. After periods of imprisonment and rehab, he says he's now sober. He's making a comeback with the new movie, The Singing Detective. Those of us who are his fans are grateful to have him back. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Federal officials say they've found the highly toxic and potentially fatal substance ricin in a letter at a South Carolina postal facility. Ricin is extracted from the castor bean. There's no known treatment for those who ingest it. Officials say the FBI is investigating and has a note suggesting the sender is a person unhappy with the U.S. government. Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle said today a memo from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to his staff that was leaked to USA Today acknowledges concern over failure of some administration policies. The memo questions whether the U.S. is adequately planning and executing the war on terrorism. It says it will be a hard slog to achieve objectives in Iraq and Afghanistan. Rumsfeld said the memo was his way of asking questions and encouraging imaginative thinking. A new independent report says UN security management failed to provide adequate protection for UN staff in Iraq. The report says the failure has resulted in avoidable casualties. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The General Assembly voted 144-4 with 12 abstentions to condemn the Israeli barrier. The vote comes a week after the United States vetoed a similar measure in the UN Security Council, criticizing it for being one-sided. And earlier Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte said Washington opposes any UN resolution on the subject that does not name specific Palestinian militant groups such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad, which claim responsibility for committing suicide bombings in Israel. Israel maintains the barrier is needed for security reasons. General Assembly resolutions, unlike Security Council measures, are not legally binding on member states. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo in New York.
In New York City, the captain of the Staten Island ferry that crashed into a pier last week still refuses to cooperate with authorities. 10 people died in the accident. George Bodarkey of member station WFUV reports.
The city is taking steps to fire ferry captain Michael Gansis after he refused for a second day to meet with federal investigators, despite a subpoena ordering him to talk. Gansis has already been suspended from his job. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is losing patience, saying the captain's lack of cooperation is deplorable.
It's an outrage that somebody who can give us information to perhaps find out how we can improve service refuses to talk.
The captain's attorney says his client is under medical care and still too traumatized to talk. Captain Gansis was not at the controls when the ferry crashed, but investigators say his whereabouts are an important part of the investigation. For NPR News, I'm George Bodarkey in New York.
It was a big selling day today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials finished down 149 points at 95.98 in heavy trading of over 1.6 billion shares. The Nasdaq was down 43 at 18.98. The S&P 500 down 15 at 10.30. This is NPR News. Senate Democrats today blocked a favorite bill of President Bush that would have limited class action lawsuits and large damage awards against businesses. A vote to avoid a Democratic filibuster came up one shy of the 60 needed to move the bill forward. So the bill, which lacked only Senate approval, is apparently dead for this session. Game 4 of the World Series is scheduled for tonight in Miami. The New York Yankees lead the Florida Marlins 2-1. Tonight, the Marlins will try to rediscover their hitting touch against all-star pitcher Roger Clemens. He's starting the final game of his career. NPR's Tom Goldman reports from Miami.
Since their victory in the opening game of the series, the Marlins have lost twice and been outscored by the Yankees 12-2. But after last night's 6-1 loss in Game 3, Florida manager Jack McKeon said his team can come back the way it did after trailing the Chicago Cubs 3-1 in the National League Championship Series.
It turned around. Our pitching became pretty good. and our hitting picked us up. Guys that you see out there not doing a job now, or not hitting the ball now, all of a sudden in the crucial three-game series against the Cubs when we had to win all three games, they delivered. So I'm looking for the same thing to happen.
Tonight the Marlins will have to start their comeback in an emotionally charged game. New York's Roger Clemens, one of the greatest pitchers of all time, is making the final start of his career. The 41-year-old Clemens says he'll retire when the season's over. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Miami.
Race car driver Tony Renna died today in a crash at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He lost control and hit the wall at nearly 220 miles per hour during a test drive. Renna was 26. He made his Indianapolis Racing League debut last year. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, offering accredited online bachelor's, master's, and Ph.D. programs. Capella University at 1-888-CAPELLA.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osman's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House Incorporated, publisher of After Breast Cancer, A Common Sense Guide to Life After Treatment by Hester Hill Schnipper.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories.
And that's the opening of Law and Order, the longest-running drama on network television. My guest, Dick Wolf, is the creator and executive producer of Law and Order and its two popular spin-offs, Special Victims Unit and Criminal Intent. He also created the series Crime and Punishment and The New Dragnet. Earlier in his career, he worked as a writer and or producer on such shows as Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice, and New York Undercover. Now Dick Wolf has a new book called Law and Order that includes many crime scene photos from the series, as well as essays by several of the key people who work on the show. The first season of each of the Law and Order shows is now on DVD. Here's a scene from the first episode of the original Law and Order. The detectives are George Zunza and Chris Noth, who later became the character Big on Sex and the City. The guest star is John Spencer, who now plays the chief of staff on the West Wing.
Where was she murdered?
I told you, Urban Medical Center.
I'm sorry, Mr. Morton. I'm a little confused. Your daughter was killed at the hospital?
Yeah, in the emergency room, and I want to swear out a murder complaint against the resident in charge of it.
This resident was treating her?
No, killing her.
But she was at the hospital for treatment.
Yeah, a sore throat, muscle aches. She only went in to get a prescription for some antibiotics.
Well, sometimes people are a lot sicker than they look.
Listen to me. Was a medic in Vietnam. I know who's dying and who isn't. My daughter was not that sick. Somebody in that emergency room did something that killed her.
One of the things that's pretty consistent in the writing, in, stylistically and content-wise, is that you don't find out much about the private lives of the detectives or the prosecutors. It's really driven by the story. Why did you make that decision?
The wonderful thing about procedurals is that it does away with the necessity for soap opera. In other words, when you're not dealing with the personal lives of the characters, you can concentrate on the story. You can tell a complete story with a beginning, middle, and an end. And it's quite efficient in terms of dealing with complicated issues, dealing with moral issues that, we've been saying the same thing for years, that the first half is a murder mystery and the second half is a moral mystery. So it's how do you keep those elements unpolluted by the sex lives of the characters or going home with them. They're workplace shows, and I think that there is a fascination of just watching people at work without those sideline distractions of their personal lives.
And, you know, another thing the shows have in common, you've tried to do away with, you know, the establishing shots. You say you don't really want to spend a lot of time with the characters, kind of getting from one scene to another, getting in and out of rooms. What are some of those things that you wanted to kind of streamline or just take out altogether and just keep the action going?
That's you've annotated several of them already. That I think that one of the realities is that there is enough information in either side of the show to make a completely satisfying hour cop show or a completely satisfying hour legal show. The fact that you have to give what in many cases is twice as much information in the same 43 minutes that you have in a character-driven show, to tell this much story, you don't have time to go home with the characters. I mean, the pace of the show, the average hour show has about 26 scenes per episode. Law and Order usually has between 40 and 42. So that's a huge differential in terms of the pacing and in terms of the way scenes are structured on the shows.
Now, I know you worked in advertising before you started working in television. You worked for doing advertising mostly for Procter & Gamble products like Crest and Scope.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Are there things you learned in advertising that you were able to apply to television?
Yeah, you learned the same thing that you learn in the military, that you should really go through life with a KISS attitude, which is keep it simple, stupid. You know, this is, it's one of those things that you do want direct and kind of unfiltered communication.
Would we know any of the campaigns you did for Crest or Scope? Did you write any of the jingles
or
slogans?
Scope fights bad breath without giving you medicine breath. There's one of the undying...
Oh, medicine breath. That was yours.
Yeah, and one of my favorites was you can't beat Crest for fighting cavities, which is a wonderfully neutral statement, that it's a parody statement as opposed to a competitive advantage, that there can be 400 other toothpastes that are as good, but nothing's better than Crest. And that lasted a long time.
That's great. No one can sue you over that one.
Yes, sir, you can use whatever toothpaste you want, but none of them are any better. And then National Airlines, which was probably the most controversial campaign that I was ever involved with. And I'm sure you're too young to remember, but it outraged.
Oh, try me.
Try me? Fly me. I'm Cheryl, Fly Me. Remember National Airlines?
Well, that was, Fly Me was yours?
Yeah, that's a long time ago. That's over 30 years ago now.
Oh, that was controversial because of for feminist reasons.
Yes, it was.
Right.
That was the
It sounded like a sexual
feminism.
Innuendo.
Well, it was.
So much of advertising was then. I mean, of advertising still is, but it was all more innuendo than overt.
It was very, very direct innuendo because they had a very specific goal in mind, that National Airlines had by far the highest percentage of business travelers in the early 70s going to Florida. And the reason was the stewardesses. That was the age of mini skirts that were so short that the stewardesses were not allowed to bend over in the cabin. They had to sort of do a semi-curtsy when they were serving people. And National really wanted a campaign directed at businessmen about the stewardesses. So it may have lacked some subtlety, but it did get talked about.
Oh, and I just have to ask you, the medicine breath, with no disrespect to Listerine, was it Listerine that you were thinking of there?
Yes. Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dick Wolf, and he's the creator and executive producer of all the Law & Order TV shows. And by the way, there's a DVD of the first season of Law & Order, and there's a new Law & Order book that's a combination of crime scene photographs and essays by many of the people who work on Law & Order, including, of course, Dick Wolf. Did you always like police procedurals?
Oh, since I was about 6 years or 7 years old and started reading The Hardy Boys. I mean, I grew up reading The Hardy Boys and then Sherlock Holmes, and I was always interested by crime for some reason. But it paid, it's one of those strange things that crime can actually pay, but that's probably not the right message to send.
No, you want to send the message TV pays.
Ah, well. TV is life, I think that's...
One of the things you have to do every week is cast a dead body.
Ah.
You know, actors like to come in and show you their stuff. How do you audition to be dead?
It's a very, very complex process because everybody wants to be the dead body. It's the only thing that I'm constantly getting requests to be from people that, you know, can I be the dead body? And it's highly sought after because you can't be cut out. So it's a great gig for extras.
Yeah, but you can't. You don't get to emote or anything.
No, but, you know, then you also, nobody can comment on your bad acting either.
I guess. So so what is the audition process like for the bodies?
Well, it's usually kind of direct that there's a description of the body in the script, and then they try to find an extra who looks like that description. And in many instances, people who have wanted to be the dead body will come in and something has changed to reflect that in terms of some of the people who have played dead bodies over the years.
Have you become, I don't know if there's a word for this, somebody who hangs out at crime scenes and... I don't.
That's a level of... I guess buffed them that no, I've spent an inordinate amount of time with cops, but not really at that many crime scenes in the last 15 or 18 years. I used to go to them a lot when I was starting out writing this stuff.
How would you go? Did you have a police band radio?
No, I had a couple of homicide cops in L.A., and one of the aims was to see one of every kind of crime or one of every kind of murder, you know, that there was, it was an open call if there was a shooting, stabbing, garroting, something that was a little unique, Stan White or his partner would call, and we'd go out and see it. And I think the strangest crime scene I ever went to was on Super Bowl Sunday about 15 years ago, and I got a call from Stanley to meet him in Bell, which is one of the worst sections of L.A., and I walked in, and it was this apartment that was in kind of a motel complex. And there were three uniformed cops sitting on the sofa in this apartment watching the Super Bowl. And I said, God, this doesn't look like a crime scene. And then I walked 2 feet further in, and there was a body inside the closet, upside down, wrapped up in telephone cord, with his eyes open, watching the game along with the cops. It was... these three cops sitting there, absolutely no interest in this body 2 feet away from them, but they were into the game.
Did you go to these crime scenes with two different mindsets? One being, this is really horrible, this is tragic, this is the end of a life, and the other being, this is really interesting, let me study what it looks like so I can, you know, accurately render it in my series?
Unfortunately, I wish I'd had the former thought occasionally. It was always the latter. This is kind of interesting. There's no personal involvement. It's how cops do it. You know, that it's almost like coming in... you're almost seeing a movie when you go to these things because they can be so horrific, but there is... if you're a writer, certainly, and you're interested, there... the attraction far outweighs any kind of moral quandaries that you might find yourself in.
So you didn't ask yourself, what's wrong with me? I'm not having an emotional reaction.
Not really. It was kind of like, wow, look at that.
Uh-huh.
It's not stuff you see ordinarily. I mean, and some of the stuff that happens in police work is so bizarre that I remember we went to a crime scene. There had been a shootout between two drug dealers inside an apartment. They had managed to kill each other, and there were it looked like there had been a third person there, and there had been 96 rounds fired in this apartment in the middle of West Hollywood, and it was about a 16 unit building, and we went around and started interrogating all the tenants because the shooting had taken place at like 4 in the morning, and nobody had heard anything.
Right.
Nope, didn't hear a thing. 96 shots? That's, you know, a lot of gunfire.
Did the cops interpret that as the tenants didn't want to play ball with the cops, or the tenants were afraid? I mean, were they afraid of retribution, or did they just hate the cops?
No, I don't think they hated the cops. I think that there is a, especially in the middle of that neighborhood, there is a disinclination to become involved.
Right,
I think
right.
that it wasn't massive fear. It was just like, hey, they're dead. Who cares? You know, it's that they were drug dealers. And that attitude does kind of permeate certain neighborhoods.
My guest is Dick Wolf, the creator and executive producer of Law & Order and its two spinoffs, Special Victims Unit and Criminal Intent. His new Law & Order book includes many still photographs of crime scenes from the series. This is Fresh Air. Whether it's an interview with the creator of a hit TV series or a journalist just returned from Iraq, we have the luxury of time to talk in depth. That's one of the many unique qualities of public radio. It's one of the reasons why I like working in public radio, and I figure it's one of the reasons you like listening. Why can we do what other radio stations don't? Because we're not creating programs to suit the needs of advertisers. We go directly to our listeners for support. Your station is fundraising today. I hope you'll make a pledge now. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview with Dick Wolf, the creator of Law & Order and its two spinoffs. He has a new Law & Order book. I'm sure you'd seen a lot of crime in movies and television and read a lot of books with crime. Were there some things that just really astonished you about how real murder looks?
Yeah, it's a lot bloodier than we showed on television.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the one of the things that probably, unfortunately, most people who tell you that have gone to a crime scene is there. It's surprising how much blood there is in a human body. It's much worse than we've ever shown on the show.
And why don't you show that much blood on the show?
Because I think it's one of those things that, because if my reaction going to a crime scene is, wow, that's a lot of blood, I think that if you put that amount on television in a totally realistic way every week, it's kind of upsetting. And I don't think you need to be that graphic to communicate what we're trying to do. And if you look, one of the things that's fascinating about the book is if you look at the book
mm-hmm.
and you look at some of the crime scenes in the book, they look much worse much more realistic in the photographs than they do even on the show, because you're never lingering on them. The camera is always sort of passing over the stuff that's extremely disturbing. But in the book, you get the feeling that, oh, this really is a crime scene. And that's part of the fascination.
And when you actually saw these real murders, was there anything that surprised you about the faces, the expressions on the victims' faces?
Well, the guy in the closet looked quite surprised,
mm-hmm.
but he was upside down, so I don't know, you know, what lividity has to do with that. But there are,
right.
I would say that people kind of say, if there was one expression, it wasn't pain. It was kind of like, what happened? It's, you know, surprise.
Right.
I don't think people usually expect to get shot. It's also one of the things that most cops will tell you, that the most common thing is never ask to be shot, because a lot of drunken altercations and a lot of street confrontations, somebody pulls a gun and somebody else says, oh, yeah, you're so tough, go ahead and shoot. Okay. And homicide cops will tell you the number of killers that they've arrested to say, well, he told me to shoot him.
That's really interesting, because in a lot of crime movies and TV shows, somebody who is kind of tough and challenging, and sometimes the hero himself or herself will say, yeah, go ahead and shoot me. And then the person gets really weak, and because the hero is wise enough to know that the person doesn't have the courage to do it. And that
One homicide detective told me it is the single most common line in homicides. Wow. Go ahead and shoot.
That's really, really interesting. And that makes me think, too, about the kind of wise guy language that a lot of people use in TV shows and in movies. Smart aleck stuff, where somebody's got a gun on you and you're quipping.
Oh, yeah. No,
bad idea in real life?
It's not a smart thing to do. You know, the best solution to anybody having a, if you ever have a gun pointed at you, give them whatever they ask for immediately.
Including some respect?
I'd be polite.
Right, right. How does this affect the dialogue that you write and the dialogue that you edit for Law & Order?
Well, you see, it's not really much of a problem because by the time the show starts, they're already dead.
Yeah, but there's still other, you know, the cops, the detectives are hunting for the killer, and they sometimes get in tough situations, and friends of the victim sometimes get in tough situations, too.
Yeah, I think it's much more, the hallmark of, and Jerry is the one who said this, that Law & Order is kind
Jerry
of like
Orbach.
Jerry Orbach is kind of like a Catholic high mass, that it's a rite, that the audience knows what's going to happen, not in terms of the storytelling, but that there is a rhythm to the show. And I'd say one of the rhythms that is now part and parcel of it is Jerry's kind of mordantly acerbic comment at the end of the teaser, which has become part of just sort of the Law & Order mantra, that there is a setup line and then Jerry gets to get the last line in the teaser, which invariably is kind of a either acerbic, sarcastic, or insightful comment about the stupidity of murder.
Law & Order, one of the things it's known for is that a lot of the shows are, you know, the kind of, quote, rip from the headlines type of shows, where they're based on actual news stories.
No, they're not based on there. We steal the headline, but not the body copy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, I mean, if you actually have knowledge of any of the cases that as they unroll, you go, oh, that's that case. It never is. That's the headline, the top of mind awareness is what we're after. And then, you know, the reality is most real life murders take a very predictable road to fruition, that they, you know, most murders are solved within the first 48 hours and most people are convicted. That does not give you the twists and turns that make for an entertaining hour of television.
Well, we're out of time, regretfully. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And how can I get so many shows on television?
Well, you're on radio.
Oh, that's right.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, and congratulations on your many shows, and thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dick Wolf is the executive producer of Law & Order and its two spin-offs, Special Victims Unit and Criminal Intent. He has a new Law & Order book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Robert Downey Jr. talks about his life, acting, and getting sober. He's starring in the new film The Singing Detective, based on the Dennis Potter miniseries that was shown on public television.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com. And from DK Publishing, publishers of Smithsonian Institution, The Story of the West, a history of the American West and its people.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I am among the many people who think Robert Downey Jr. is a terrific actor. Unfortunately, for several years, his talent was a hostage to his drug addiction. After several comebacks that were cut short by drugs and after spending time in prison and rehab, Downey says he's now sober, and for the first time since 1996, he's clear of all legal constraints. Downey's films include Chaplin, True Believer, Less Than Zero, The Pickup Artist, Natural Born Killers, Wonder Boys, and Bowfinger. He won a Golden Globe for his performance in Ally McBeal. Now he's starring in the film adaptation of the Dennis Potter miniseries The Singing Detective, which was broadcast in America on public television. He plays a detective novelist who has a crippling form of psoriasis, which also afflicted Potter. Flare-ups leave his entire body covered in scabs and peeling skin and bring on high fevers and hallucinations. They also exaggerate his resentments and despair. The movie cuts back and forth between the hospital room in which he's being treated, flashbacks of his childhood, and the hallucinations in which he becomes the detective of his novels, a detective who also sings in a rock and roll band. In this scene, Downey is in the hospital in a session with his psychiatrist, played by Mel Gibson.
Well, physically, you're on the up. Now we have a firm grasp of the obvious. Why do you still feel so disappointed in things as they are?
Things as they are. No concern of mine.
You object to the use of the word things?
There's a lot of words I don't like.
Such as?
Decaffeinated.
Another.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, indoor games?
Yeah.
Word games?
Yeah, sure, I throw you a word. You
I come back with another word.
Yeah, that you associate with the word that I, you know.
Okay, wait. Yeah, but we gotta agree in advance that it's meaningless. Right, oh. Please. There's no diagnostic value, really.
Fine.
Judge.
Oh, skin.
Scales.
Weight.
Tables.
Restaurant.
Gastroenteritis.
Robert Downey Jr., welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You have a dual role, and the patient part of your role is in the hospital the whole time, too sick to really move much. And he's going crazy both from the fever of the illness but also from the confinement of the hospitalization.
Exactly.
And he's totally trapped in his head and in these fantasies in his head and in the flashbacks that are also going through his mind. And I'm wondering if it's not too personal to ask if you related to this character from your own confinements, either in rehab or in prison.
It's interesting because, again, I kind of got it more as we went along. And, you know, I'm not an ignoramus or anything, but it's kind of like if you took somebody out of, like, Folsom and then said, now we're shooting a prison movie. You know what I mean? They'd be like, oh, I know what you're talking about, I think. And then pretty soon they'd be like, well, let's see, when he says chow time, how should I react? You know, I mean, it's like, for me, I was focused mostly on what was right in front of me.
Right.
Which was, you know, a big challenge, a high degree of difficulty. And retrospectively, I now have found it somewhat cathartic, particularly when I see the audience watch the film and get it, and then I can relax a little bit, and then I watch it and I start to get it, not just as a film, but as a parallel, you know, to my own life.
I think that's interesting that you'd see that as a viewer, but you didn't consciously try to work with it as an actor.
Well, I did it at certain points, but, you know, for instance, I've never been tarred and feathered.
Mm-hmm.
That I remember.
That's good.
And yet that was the physical feeling mm-hmm. of the makeup, the way it was applied, the way
right.
you put on the prosthesis, there was
uh-huh.
a lot of paint and gooey substances on top. And then over that, there was a gelatin shellac that was applied, dried at high heats and then cracked to mirror the flaking effect of the dead skin. So, I mean, that was just ridiculous. You know, but I'm not used to being uncomfortable in that way. So it was kind of new, somewhat.
All I could think of while you were describing that is, I hope you had a good dermatologist. All I could think of was rashes from all that stuff.
You know, the funny thing is, we initially did a makeup test, and they were commencing principal photography out in the desert. And so we did the test out there in a trailer, and they were just going to town. They really, really were a talented group of guys and gals, and they wanted to do a great job, so they just went to town. This is, oh, we'll do this leg like stage five. Oh, let's do the face like stage one. And, you know, I kind of, anyway, it was excruciating. And I'm certain they didn't mean to injure me in any way, but it dried so hard. It was like someone had shellacked my forehead and then, you know, hit it with a ball peen hammer. And there was some scars and some chemical burns and all that stuff. So after that test, things got a lot more geared towards effective visual and effective for the longevity of the subject. So, you know, they wised up pretty quick.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Downey Jr., and he stars in the new movie of Dennis Potter's story, The Singing Detective. Now, this is your first big film role since being clean for a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, stop me if this is too personal, but I figure for anybody who wants to work with you now, they're probably asking themselves, am I taking a big risk here? Is he going to be okay for the whole film? Do you feel like you're in the position where you have to, like, prove yourself to everybody if you accept a job?
I think proving oneself has to do with a deficit in confidence or self-trust. And up until a couple years ago, even before I had any real dependency on drugs, that might have been true. I've never missed a day of work in my life. I've never been the reason that something couldn't continue. That's not entirely true now that I think about it, because there were bleed-throughs from things. I mean, it's just miraculous, really, that throughout everything I've been able to always continue working and not put myself too much at the mercy of having to do something I didn't believe in. Nowadays, the truth is, someone said this to me. They said I'm actually the least risky person to work with, if you know me and where I'm at. And there's a lot of sleepers out there. You never know when they're gonna show you they got a little problem.
Why are you least risky right now, do you think?
Because I might as well have a urinalysis machine hooked up to the internet. You know, and I'm fortunate in that way. It takes what it takes. And for me, it's nothing external has ever been enough. But now, as one of my mooring lines, and I'm, you know, not too proud to admit it, you know, I am not afforded the dubious luxury of deception. If I'm doing all right, it's obvious. If I'm not doing all right, even a little bit, it's obvious.
Right. Some people say that they think that being incarcerated actually, you know, saved their lives because it forced them to be without drugs. Other people say, well, you get drugs in prison. But, you know, I've heard both sides of that.
You know, whatever floats your boat, some people are so afraid of being in the box that fear works for them. Some people are so afraid of being in the box again that works. I've never really had much of a fear of either. You know, it didn't work for me at all, and it could never work for me because, you know, I like a good box.
You were okay being, you know, being alone and confined?
Well, it was awful, like, but, yeah, I wasn't, you know, it's not like I was like, I can't take this anymore. Oh, God, why me? I was like, oh, I'm in a box. This sucks. What am I going to read today?
My guest is Robert Downey Jr. He's starring in the new movie, The Singing Detective. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ah! My guest, if you're just joining us, is Robert Downey Jr., and he's starring in the new film, The Singing Detective, which is has a screenplay by Dennis Potter, who also did The Singing Detective for BBC. That was shown on public television, and he did Pennies from Heaven as well. You always strike me as a really brave actor, someone really willing to take risks. And a lot of the personalities that you've played in your films are those really edgy personalities, people who are obsessive, or they're liars, or they're just, they're kind of over the top in some way or the other. Mm-hmm. And the roles that I think of, the movies I think of there are Pickup Artist, Two Girls and a Guy, Wonder Boys. I just think it's so much fun watching you on screen. There's a scene, God, I forget what the song is, but there's a scene in Two Girls and a Guy, which is a James Toback film, in which you're basically lying to everybody in your life in that movie. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where you break out into song, and I'm forgetting what the song is.
Oh, Jackie Robinson's You Don't Know Me?
That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
Can you just talk about that scene a little bit?
Oh, yeah. He's he goes into his apartment. The two gals.
This is it, yeah.
Philandering or hiding in the loft closet. And he gets home and he calls both of them on the telephone and tells them they're the only one. And you know, we know that that's about to blow up. But he's still thinking everything's cool. And he goes over to his piano microphone and sings to himself in kind of a less than serious way.
Why don't we hear that part of the scene?
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello, and I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell. You think you know me? No, you don't know. No, you don't know the one who dreams of you at night, afraid and shy. Honey, I let my chance go by, the chance you might have loved me too.
It's a really fun scene, I have to say. And you've been singing more since then. You sang on Ally McBeal. You sing the final song in The Singing Detective, even though your character is lip-syncing in the credit sequence at the end. You're actually singing. Do you like to sing?
I've always liked it, and I always encourage people to say, I can't really sing. I go, you know what? It's fundamentally impossible for the human body to not be able to produce, hold, carry, and interact in complex ways with tones and music and all that stuff. It's our nature. 3.5 billion years of DNA saying sing.
So what do you most like to sing?
I've composed stuff since I was 17.
Really?
I have a big stockpile of stuff. Again, you know, here's my fear. You know, I'm confident about my work. I know it's good. I just wouldn't want to release it as a lark. I would want to really, really. And I was with Sting in Chicago just a day or two ago and went and saw him in Grant Park for a big fundraiser for Save the Music. And, you know, he will sell no wine before it's time. And so, you know, I kind of am cautioned against just doing that, you know, instant gratification. Let me put out some of the stuff I've written, you know. I'm told I'm kind of a perfectionist in my work as an actor, and it doesn't even hold a candle to how I feel about music.
Robert Downey Jr. is my guest, and he's starring in the new movie, The Singing Detective. So how old were you when you got your first agent?
I was doing a play at the Colonnades across from the Public Theater when I wasn't bussing tables at the Central Falls, right down the street on West Broadway. And I was in a play called Fraternity about SMU. And someone came to see one of the other actors in it who wound up having an interesting career himself. And they asked if they could talk to me and said that they'd be interested in signing me. And the funny thing was, I really was working as hard as I could when I did that little play, and I didn't expect much out of it, but I'd get there an hour and a half before curtain, and I'd do, I was like 16 or 17, I would do yoga, and I would run over the scenes, and I would go out and touch the lights, and, you know, all this kind of really ethereal approach to doing a little, like, 60-seat theater who gives a damn play, you know, but I needed that, and I ritualized it, and it's funny, you know, it's almost like I never have worked as hard since in a certain fashion as I did right at the very, 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 very beginning in theater.
Who were you hoping to become? Was there an actor or a certain type of actor that you think you were modeling yourself on?
Well, let's see. Later on, when I was already up and running, Sean Penn was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I was hugely affected by Matt Dillon, Ralph Macchio,
mm-hmm.
Scott Baio, you know, all the guys who seem like, wow, look at him go. And then when I got out to California, the whole Brat Pack thing was already sealed up and rolling, and I thought they were all amazing.
What about older films? Did you watch a lot of older films when you were getting started?
Well, let me put it this way. I remember my dad bringing me to see, like, Slaughterhouse-Five and Le Grand Bouff and Truffaut movies. And I mean, it's amazing the things that I saw before I was 10 years old.
What, isn't Le Grand Bouff the movie where they eat themselves to death? Is that Le Grand Bouff?
Exactly. Wasn't that great?
Oh, I hated that film.
It was awful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember the scene where the couple was making love and someone's knocking at the door and the guy says, I'm coming. And I was like, why is that funny? God, I don't get anything. And then as often as not, we'd be watching other movies and my dad would just stand up and say, we're gone. I'd be like, why? He goes, oh, this thing's scuffed. And we didn't even make it through the opening credits. He like didn't like the visual and we were splitting.
Well, that might have been helpful, though. Was he always pointing out these things that you never would have noticed as a child if you didn't have a filmmaker father to point them out?
Sure. And but aside from that, I was given a very, very specific education. You know, I mean, Preston Sturges was, you know, we named our Yorkshire Terrier after him. Kubrick, as I said before, that was our cat. You know, I mean, it was like everything was about great directors in our household and writers.
My guest is Robert Downey Jr. He's starring in the new movie, The Singing Detective. This is Fresh Air. I hope you make a pledge during this break, and so does everyone else who listens to Fresh Air. Here's why. Your station relies on your pledge so that it can pay the fee that we charge to broadcast our program. What do we do with that money? We use it to produce the show, along with the money from our underwriters. So your pledge truly makes it possible for you to continue listening to Fresh Air. I thank you for your support. Let's get back to our interview with actor Robert Downey Jr. He's starring in the new film, The Singing Detective. Your father was a filmmaker. What did you think of, like, movie making as a life?
I didn't think of anything else as a life. I mean, I knew I had friends whose fathers were doctors or worked down at, the sporting goods store, which is great because I wanted a BB gun. You know, I mean, it was like... It just seemed like, and I have to credit my folks with this, you know, it was a very organic approach to something technical, artistic, and kind of otherworldly. And then my mother was a is a very, very gifted actress and singer and comedian. And my father was primarily a writer who decided that he should direct what he wrote to kind of keep it true to his original intent. And it's an amazing director, very influential director. And but more importantly than that was I had this sense of if you wanted to do something that seemed like only a small percentage of people on Earth were chosen to do that, you could do whatever you wanted. My dad always says this. He goes, anybody can act. Hardly anybody can direct. And nobody can write. So in descending order, I'm kind of in, you know, I get the bronze medal. You know, but
your father, Robert Downey, is most famous for his film Putney Swope, which was a comedy about the advertising industry and about race. What impact did it have on your life when that film became popular? How old were you then?
I was 3 or 4 when it came out. I think what it was is there was a huge reaction to it, particularly from, you know, the 10 or 12 guys, you know, that are my dad's age who've really kind of formed the artistic element of Maverick filmmaking since. And so the only impact it really had on me was I knew that my dad was something really, really, really special. And I remember this day that he was wearing a Superman shirt because that was kind of like the kind of shirts you were getting down on Bleecker Street instead of the NYPD shirts or, you know, whatever now it is. And I just remember, there's my dad, and he's wearing a Superman shirt. And he had a throne in his bedroom.
He had a throne in his bedroom?
You know, imagine what year it was, too. We're talking, you know, this is like 33 years ago. You know, everyone had a throne in their bedroom.
Oh, of course.
Come on, you know, or they had the glass beads going into the kitchen, and, you know, the kitchen had a big, like, smiley face hubcap on the wall. I mean, it was great. Everyone's cat was named something like George Washington or Kubrick or whatever.
So I'm getting the picture that you're really, like, the child of hippie parents. Very successful film world hippie parents.
Isn't that funny? Because they were actually squares.
Really?
But the same way that, you know, I might be considered a square by people who really know me. And then before I go out to this premiere tonight, I'll put on, like, you know, a Helmut Lang shirt and a pair of cool glasses and, you know, somebody else's jacket that I have to return in a week. And it's like, whoa, look at him. He's mod. You know, no, I'm not. I'm a total nerd. I just clean up nice once in a while.
Was there a lot of structure in your life when you were growing up?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there was a structure. There was a structure, all right. Kind of like, that's how complexes are created, out of structures.
So, really, was there like discipline and structure, or were you pretty free to do whatever?
I went to school, you know. Went to school. I was in judo. I was in chorus. I was in drama. And that's all I got.
You dropped everything out of school at the age of 17, right?
Yes, gladly.
Right.
Things had gotten to the point where mom and dad split up. Dad's going back east. He said, you can stay or you can go. And then he left. And I was like, why am I staying with a buddy of mine from high school in a garage in the Venice Canals? I got to get out of here. I got to go to New York. So I went back to New York where I was from. And then I started working in theater and kind of put a little career together. And I couldn't have done both. I couldn't have finished out the school year, waited till summertime and then gone back east. I wouldn't have made it. I didn't have any dough. I had a job at Thrifty's, but all of us got fired because two of us were stealing. And, you know, it was just time. It was time to move on.
So did you go for, like, acting training, or did you just go right into auditions?
Kind of both. I realized quickly that I was never going to get a Casio commercial or a Dr. Pepper spot because I couldn't bring myself to say, when the lady comes in and goes, you're the Pied Piper and everyone wants to be like you. Now let's get the next group in. And I was like, oh my God, I gotta go. No, you don't have to go. Come in here. We're doing the auditions. I was like, no, I swear to God, I don't know how to sell a little keyboard. Well, of course, now I would because I'm technically proficient. But I learned, you know that little movie out, Todd Graff's movie Camp?
Oh, I love that film.
I went to Stage Door Manor.
Did you really?
Sure.
This is a summer camp for the performing arts.
Yes, and Locke Sheldrake it was initially, and Todd Graff and I were in, you know, plays and learned stuff. And
no, wait, one of the funny things about camp, about the movie, is that they do these, like, overly sophisticated, ambitious, like, Sondheim musicals. It's 12-year-olds. Were you in a position like that?
Join us now, we're on a marathon. Jacques Brel is alive and well, living in Paris. Jules Pfeiffer presents. I was like, who are all these people? It's like, shut up, light a Newport. Come here, kid. It was great. Never forget it. And then there was regional theater, and then there was off-Broadway and musicals. And so, you know, in my own way, you know, when I'm out west, you know, there's very few people who were afforded the kind of training I was. Like, what did you do? Well, I surfed, and I went to Baja, and I went to Club Med and got some drink beads, and then I, like, did a movie. You know, it's like I had it a little different than that.
Well, I really want to wish you good luck, and, you know, with your movies and with life and everything. And I really thank you for doing the interview. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, this was good.
Robert Downey Jr. is starring in the new movie, The Singing Detective. It opens Friday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Robert Downey Jr. singing from the soundtrack of The Singing Detective.
In my dreams, you told me that you really, really care. In my dreams, you told me it's love that can't compare. So hold me, hold me, hold me, and never ever let me go. In my dreams, you told me it's a love that can't compare. In my dreams, you told me it's love you wanna share. So hold me, hold me, hold me, never ever let me go.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story behind the Serenity Prayer, the prayer adapted by AA, which asks for the ability to accept what cannot be changed, the courage to change the things that should be changed, and the wisdom to tell the difference. It was written in 1943 by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. We'll talk with his daughter, Elizabeth Sifton. Join us for the next Fresh Air.